think that computer is sitting there. That's my country computer, which is giving me little messages.
It turned on, and I'm not gonna touch anything.
Okay.
So, this is Ruth Swanson, and today is November 9th, 2010, and I'm with, and I want to say it right, Vera Jelinek, Dr. Mm-hmm. Vera Jelinek, who's a graduate of Bologna First, and then SAIS in Washington, and your certificate from Bologna was in 57, is that right? And SAIS was 58.
Right.
And so you were just telling me some stories about those first years in Italy, and I want to get back to that. But could we start with, how did you find SAIS? You know, there were a couple schools in international relations at the time, and you mentioned that you had already had an international background and spoke many languages. How did you choose SAIS over the options?
Well, you know, I went to a city college. I was a graduate of Queens College, and I had always been interested in international relations. I had participated in Model UNs and chaired some of them, and was actively involved in student life and mostly global issues. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated, you know, I don't quite remember, but I compiled a list of, I think, six schools and submitted applications. And they included SAIS, of course, and Fletcher. And Harvard, Radcliffe, and Chicago, University of Pennsylvania. You know, I mean, these were the mm-hmm. top schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so I submitted applications to all of them. I think I must have done some research to determine which schools. And I don't think that Columbia at that time was on my list. It was on my list for a PhD, but not at that point. And I heard from, I did get scholarships to, I had asked for tuition. And at that time, tuition was ridiculous. It was something like $800 at SAIS. By the time, I think the second year came around, it was $1,000. for the entire semester. And that prevailed in all the other schools as well. And I did get scholarships, tuition scholarships, to Yale, Chicago, and all, pretty much about four. And I was waitlisted, I think, in one or two places. And then I had an interview in New York for SAIS, and it was suggested that I go to Bologna. And I sort of raised an eyebrow and said, but I didn't think you sent students to Bologna the first year, which was the case. But the answer was that I spoke a number of languages. None of them, of course, was Italian. And I did get a very generous fellowship, basically, because it covered my tuition and my boat ride to Genoa and a per diem.
Mm-hmm.
And housing.
Wow.
So it was an offer that was much too good to refuse, and I was absolutely delighted. And Bologna, at that time, we were all very much pioneers, and we lived in one apartment building. We came from five different countries. The largest contingent was US, and I still see some of them, and I still see some of the Italians.
Mm-hmm.
Second largest was Italy, then we had France, we had Belgium, and we had Germany and Austria. Those were the countries. Heavily weighted on the male side, it was 38 men and 6 women. And it was an extraordinary year. And an extraordinary year, not just in the classroom, but outside the classroom. I mean, in the classroom, we did have visiting professors from Sciences Po, from Germany. Jean-Baptiste Duruzel would come every other weekend and do a huge intensive. We had my international law course with a man called Antonio La Pergola, who almost convinced me that I had to be an international lawyer. We had people from the Italian Foreign Office. Toscano, who was the Amy Nance, and all the Italians quivered whenever he gave a lecture because they were all preparing for entry into the Foreign Office. And we had a man called Gaetano Mosca, who taught East Europe. So there was, I would say it was a robust faculty. And most of all, it had a very passionate director. Grove Haines was, you know, was really very much involved about, you know, in the center, and maybe inspired me to become as involved in the center, but he was a hands-on person. It was his dream. He came out of Fletcher, not out of Saiz originally. And I visited him years later, after he retired to a farm. So we had a very close bond. And, you know, we always talk about networking here. Well, you network there. The people that were my classmates eventually ended up in foreign ministries, in the private sector. I ran into one of them at a Japanese restaurant who lives in New York a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, we've seen each other at reunions, at Bologna reunions. And, of course, the current head of Bologna is somebody that I became acquainted with when he was with the Council on Foreign Relations. And I invited him to be a guest in a breakfast series that I was running here at the school. And so I visited with him and Bologna several times in the past few years. And then I came to Saiz for the second year, and that was the normal route. Some of the Americans who were, most of the Americans who were in Bologna were finishing up their master's. Bologna was their second year. But there were three Italians who then continued in Washington, and none of the Americans. I was the only one who came for a second year. But some of the Europeans who had fellowships, mostly the Italians. And I actually spent 5 days with one of them in Bologna, who was a diplomat, and I was retired, who came to Saiz for the second year. So there were very deep friendships that came out of that experience. And then came Saiz. And of course, Saiz was I won't say culture shock, but it was a little different. Mm-hmm. It was larger. It wasn't huge, but it was larger. We were still on Florida Avenue, Northwest. I had an apartment that I shared with Francine Goldberg up on 19th Street, a furnished apartment. I continued with courses that were either not offered in Bologna or that I needed. I did want to take Russia, and there was somebody from State Department, a man by the name of Boris Klausen, who was superb, who taught that. I took international economics. I took a number of courses that were missing from the curriculum in Bologna. And on the whole, it was a very good experience as well. Washington at that time was a little village, if I may say so. The cultural activities were hard to come by. I remember having to line up at the Library of Congress for tickets to the Budapest String Quartet, but there was no Kennedy Center, obviously. There was no theater, pretty much. So we could concentrate on our schoolwork. But Washington, of course, is a totally different town, which I visit at least 3 times a year just to see exhibits now. It was a good experience. I think Saiz and Bologna prepared me. It gave me a very, very solid foundation in international relations. I had been a history undergraduate, which was...
Where did you go to school?
Queen's College.
Oh, yes, you mentioned that.
And I had done history there, and that was a terrific education that I had. And then when I finished Saiz, you know, there was no email at that time, and there were only Xerox machines, but I decided that I didn't want to stay in Washington. And so I came back to New York and started looking for a job. I don't think that the opportunities that existed at that time were as extensive as they are today for IR degrees. The NGO world was rather circumscribed at that time. It existed, but it didn't allow you to do very much. International law prepared you primarily, I would say, for, if you were very good, for The Hague, which was not going to be my destiny, and you would have needed to go on for another law degree. I wasn't at that point interested in government, per se. And so I really, there were reference books on, I still remember, careers in international organizations, and I just sent out a whole bunch of resumes to everything from periodicals to international exchange organizations, you know, to others, and started to interview. And I began, I don't know if this...
I'm very interested.
The first job that I had after graduating was with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. Mm-hmm. But it was not a substantive position. It was primarily translating, translating mail that requested funding, you know, was appeal mail. But they were wonderful people, and they gave me ample time to interview elsewhere. And I applied for a Ford grant. I decided that translating wasn't what I wanted to do, so I was going to get a PhD. And I applied for a joint program at Columbia, the program on East Central Europe and the international, and it was called Public Law and Government. It was basically poli-sci and a program on East Central Europe. And I did get the Ford grant. But by that time, I had landed a fascinating job, and I had met my future husband, who was going back to do a residency in medicine. And so I refused the Ford grant and told my husband that he would have to pay for my education later, which is what happened. Mm-hmm. And I worked, I became executive director of something called the Young Adult Council, which morphed into the U.S. Youth Council, which basically what I did, it was a coordinating body for 30 national youth and student organizations, NSA, National, the youth wing of the Democratic Party, of the Republican Party, of students for SLED, Student League, not SDS, which was the subgroup of SLED, Students for Democratic Society, ADA, all of them. And while we did do things domestically, we ran a civil rights conference in Chapel Hill, the main focus was overseas, and I was preparing delegations of American so-called youth leaders who were going to attend conferences abroad, but also arranging the programs in the United States for visiting labor political leaders from newly emerged African and Asian countries. Most of them were left of center, and they were sponsored by parts of our government. So that I programmed for the Jeunesse du Rassemblement Démocratique Africain, which was Sékou Touré's youth wing, for their 2 month stay in the U.S. Same thing for the Jeunesse Ouvrière Marocaine, which was the opposition group to Mouly Hassan II in Morocco. And I think it was an excellent program because it strengthened U.S. ties to opposition groups in those countries, and these opposition groups eventually came to power in many of the countries. So, for example, I did the program for what was then called Southern and Northern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland, which eventually became Zambia and Zimbabwe. And it was basically utilizing what I had learned, you know, historically and otherwise about Africa and Asia and politics, but it was also people skills.
Well, and this leads us to the next question, which is, what would you like historians to know about your career? And it sounds like you were at the cusp of some pretty interesting things.
About my career, I think I would concentrate on my last 26 years here. I would point out
And here is the New York...
It's the Center for Global Affairs at NYU School of Continuing and Professional Studies. It's a center that I helped to launch. But I really began here in 1984 by setting up an international affairs program. That means courses and events within the School of Continuing and Professional Studies. And out of that came a very robust continuing education program, public events, as well as the graduate program, which was launched in 2004. I transitioned back into the workforce when I started in 1984. It was not a continuum. I stopped after the U.S. Youth Council and raised a family and went back for a PhD. I would say that the re-entry back into the workforce was very challenging. It was difficult. I perhaps stayed out a little bit too long. If I had to do it over again, I would not have stayed on as long, because it was difficult to prove without a continuous track record that I could do something. I knew I could do it. I wanted to try the private sector, and I didn't have much experience in the private sector, so I did a certificate program which is like your executive education, which was for PhDs who were retooling. It was offered by what was then the Graduate School of Business at NYU. And as a result of that, I interviewed with American Express and with American Can and with the banks. But eventually, somebody placed my resume on the desk of the dean of the school, and that's what began my career here. I would say that it took a lot of perseverance for me to find the right niche. And in some ways, I counsel my students here to take every opportunity and to explore it, because you never know where it may lead, and that sometimes you can create something out of very little, which is what happened here. Several lessons. I think that graduates of SAIS, for example, and other schools of IR always think of careers being more traditional careers in the private sector or in government or in international organizations. Academia also offers huge opportunities, particularly today, you know. You have a very large international student body in every school. So you've got offices of international scholars and students. You have programs like this one, which require expertise because you're building a curriculum. So you have to know what the trends are. You have to know what subject matter should be integrated into your curriculum. You have to know whom to hire. So you have to, you know, and this all comes out of that. So I would counsel students coming out of, let's say, SAIS to be aware of all sorts of opportunities that are there. I don't know if that answers some of the question.
Well, the last question is, what advice do you have for today's students?
That blends right into it.
And that blends into it. I mean, and I think you also were speaking to the challenge of re-entering the workforce after.
Is difficult, yeah. Right, but it can be done. I would say that any particular special skills that a student has, whether it's in the language arena, SAIS was always very good about that, by the way.
Continues to be.
I had 12 hours of French. I had to sit in front of a board which included members of the French Embassy in Washington. I could read, write, and speak French beautifully when I was through. And I also spoke Italian, more of a kitchen Italian, because of my having lived in Bologna for a year. But I think those are the special pluses that one brings to it. And if one has a background on the undergraduate level, be it in finance, or be it in history, or be it in an unrelated field, think of how that can be integrated into making you, you know, a different person or somebody. I think in today's world, the global is so all-encompassing that almost every field requires a global education. Right?
That's exactly what we're finding.
And that therefore the opportunities are manifold. It's not just that you can work for the CIA or just that you work for state or a ministry in another country. Yes, but there are all sorts of other opportunities. And a bit of entrepreneurship. We have students who go and do startup NGOs, who do things with technology and apply it to global. So, I really do feel this is a very, very growing field without any boundaries, which is what we teach, right? Mm-hmm. So, I've seen our students go into all sorts of successful careers. And mine, which was rather traditional at first, and then in my time, lots of women stayed home. That, of course, is very different today. And I probably wouldn't have stayed home for as long. But the PhD was worthwhile. It opens up a lot of doors, and it taught me a lot. It taught me how to write better. It taught me how to analyze. Other advice, stick to it. I would say, sometimes it'll take 6 months to get a job, sometimes it'll take a year. The other thing I would say is that in terms of preparing oneself for the workforce, there is no substitute for volunteerism, for internships, for some overseas experience. Those all come into anything that one wants to do. I don't speak languages, I mean I speak them, but not as well as I should be speaking because I don't have enough time. I did do an immersion in French again. I did lessons for about a year and a half and in Hungarian, but you know, my work is I'm here 2-3 nights a week, late. That I don't have time for that. But a smattering of a language. You know, I mean, last night, the ambassador of Poland to the UN, I could greet him by saying good evening in my broken Slovak, but that breaks barriers, and it helps. The other thing I would say is for the young professionals graduating today, or at SAIS, is don't restrict your vistas just to economics and politics and so on. Because the conversations that you will have with people in the workforce, when you're looking for a job, will be about culture too. And you have to be a cultured individual to really rise today. You have to be able to talk to donors and to advisory board members and to faculty about things other than just nitty-gritty poli-sci. Okay? You have to be able to talk about music and theater and literature. It all goes into being